Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Thanks for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Now, what is this about?
Yes, physically we would not have been seen by one of these big tankers. Whoever's driving that tanker at the time in the bridge would have seen that there is a vessel there and we had our AIS on, so we would have been seen. There were certainly some times where we had to radio some boats though and just say, look, heads up, have you seen us? Please don't run us over.
This week I have an extraordinary story of endurance. My guests are George Atfield and Oliver Rathbone, who rode over the Atlantic. My guests are also Luke Horrocks and Tom Hanlon, who helped them prepare for the adventure. But before we start, I'd like to invite you on another physical adventure, not quite rowing across the Atlantic, but do join me for a little cycle ride Tuesday, Thursday and Fridays at 12:30 on my YouTube channel, which is Relax Back UK. I will be riding my Watt bike exercise bike. You can join me on any sort of bike you like and we'll go for a pedal for half an hour or so. So not quite rowing across the Atlantic, but good fun anyway. So do come along. And right now, please do stay tuned for a fantastic show. Thank you. Yeah, so my guests today are George Atfield, Oliver Rathbone, Luke Horrocks and Tom Hanlon. And between the four of them, they have done something pretty extraordinary. So my first question to them was, what is it you've done and why on earth did you do it?
Yeah, so both George and I set off from La Gomera on November 14th and rode 3,000 miles unsupported to Antigua. It took us 39 days, 10 hours and 50 minutes. Luckily managed to land on George's 30th birthday on January the 22nd when we made land in Antigua.
Okay, so that's what you did. Why on earth would you do something like that?
I was going to say, so it has been Ollie's dream since he was 14 years old. He watched the documentary on Hell and High Water with Ben Fogel and James Cracknell. Since then, he's been hooked on it, always wanted to do it. And in November of 2022, Ollie proposed the idea to me, saying, would you be interested in doing this? I've always wanted to do it. No one would do it with me. And I was the silly friend that said yes, basically. And then since then, we were both hooked. It's quite the challenge, personal challenge, a charitable challenge. So, yeah.
So Ollie, was he the first bloke you asked? Did you try some people before that? And they said, no, I don't think I'll bother with that.
I actually watched a documentary with a friend of mine from school years and years and years ago. But he is in the military and it didn't work. So yeah, George was the first person who I called because I knew he would be stupid enough to say yes.
Great. All right. Let me ask some fairly basic questions. All right. I've seen a couple of pictures of you in the boat, but how big is the boat?
It's 8 meters by about 1.5 meters wide. So not very big.
It's not very big considering two of you were on it for like 30 days. With no escape, That's where you were. How many rowing positions are there? Is there just space for one person to row or can you both row at the same time?
There are two seats, so you can row at the same time, but if you row at the same time, it means sort of no one's resting. So we very much followed a pattern of between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. we did 1 hour of rowing and then 1 hour rest, and then between 9 p.m. and 9 a.m. so through the night we would do 2 hours of rowing and then 2 hours of rest. So we kind of alternated to make sure that one of us was getting some rest and the other one was rowing.
So the most you slept at any one time for 30 days is 2 hours?
Yeah, more like an hour and a half.
Okay, because you're not going to get to sleep immediately. Yeah.
No.
Goodness, so once me. You... that's just by itself, that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
You do get used to it in a weird way, but you don't really recover.
No, I'm sure. All right. So because I knew we were going to chat about this, I did a little bit of Googling, all right? And the photo I saw of you, there's a pretty calm sea, but I looked up size of waves on the Atlantic, all right? And it's a typical wave, so a normal sort of day. The waves are 3 to 8 meters high, and during a storm, 10 to 20 meters.
So I thought, you know, if you're on this little boat, which is 8 meters long, if a wave breaks on it, that's it. Game over. You're both dead and at the bottom of the sea, aren't you? Did that cross your minds?
It does, but after the first week, you come accustomed to knowing how the boat works, trusting the boat. The boats are very sturdy. They're made in the Netherlands by a Dutch boat maker, extremely good at his job. Like, they're sturdy. You can trust them. But it is always in the back of your mind, if you catch a rogue wave, you're going to be in a bit of trouble. We encountered some big waves. Me and Ollie said that the biggest thing we've ever seen when we're out there, these big rolling eyes of the house waves that you go up and down. It was quite something.
Yeah, they're slightly different to the waves that we might know around the coast as well, in the sense that not every wave breaks. They're, as George mentioned, they're kind of big, tall, rolling ones. Some of them can get quite high. Some of them do break on you, and those are quite scary moments. Can be a little bit sketchy, but yeah, some big weather out there.
So if you're going up a wave, one of these big ones, what sort of angle is the boat at? It must be sort of going straight up and then straight down, actually.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Considering Tom and Luke are currently on the Alps, it's kind of like reverse skiing, isn't it, really? You kind of get dragged up and you're like, this is the wrong way I should be going. But yeah, you pretty much are getting dragged on top of the way. A bit like going up an escalator in a weird way.
Goodness me. All right. Previous expeditions have, and this has been in the news, have done most of the rowing naked. Why on earth would people do that? And were you tempted?
The less clothes you wear, the less chafe you get, basically. And also your clothes get salty, sweaty, dirty, and it just has a bad impact on your body. So me and Ollie, for the first week, wore clothes, and then we soon realised, I think after the first week, all I wore was boxers. I didn't wear socks, shoes, nothing, just boxers. And Ollie was very much the same.
Yeah. Right, and so this is just because it's you kind of, with the constant rowing, constant motion, you just get really badly chafed with the seawater on your clothes.
Yeah, so you've also, because you were sitting down 12, 13 hours a day rowing, when you then get into the cabins, you can't stand in the cabins either, so you're sat down in the cabins, so you're just constantly that down, so you get like not very pleasant pressure sores, and then that combined with salt water and sweat just means that you basically don't want to wear any clothes, so you can try and dry it as much as possible. That's basically, yeah, the plan. So yeah, not much my clothing was warm.
All right, you mentioned a cabin. So how much of the time are you in the cabin, or are you just sort of exposed to the elements, exposed to the sun? When there was sun, the whole time.
Whenever you're not rowing, you can use the cabin as almost like a bedroom in a way that you can eat in there, get changed, or just rest. But as you mentioned, the sun, I think definitely as we got closer to Antigua, got worse and worse, in the sense that it's just so, so hot. These boats are made of 100% carbon fiber. So when the sun hits that, it just radiates the heat even more. It's a bit like sitting in a conservatory in the middle of June. It's really hot. So you'd be in there, but you wouldn't want to be in there for too long. You only really get in if it's too wet and big waves out on the deck. You get in the cabin, otherwise you try and stay on deck as much as possible, and you just have to suffer through the sun. You get used to it, but it is really hot.
I hope you wore a hat when you were outside.
We did.
Yeah, all right. I've got one really quite serious question for you. Did you have a plan if you were faced with a man overboard situation? Like if one of you, for whatever reason, fell out? I mean, were you tied in the whole time? When you were sleeping, when you were rowing, are you tied in? And yeah, this whole man overboard question, how did you approach that?
So it's the number one rule that gets drilled into you from day one is you always have to be tethered on. So as soon as you open the cabin door, you attach your tether. As soon as you step in, you can unattach, close the hatch. But you're always tethered on. If you had to clean the hull, you're double tethered on. And if you did have a man overboard, you have a throwing line, which if it come to it would be a last ditch attempt. But the idea is to never be in a situation where you're not attached and connected to the boat.
Goodness me. All right. So this is quite serious stuff, I guess. Let's move on and include the other two guests. There's got to be a training regime for this, because, yeah, so physically, rugby players, well, most of them anyway, are probably reasonably good at attempting something like this. But what about mentally? Because, you know, rowing for 30 days, you know, that's not going to be everybody's cup of tea at all, really, is it?
So we like to break it down into two areas, really, with the ocean community. And the first area being mental toughness. So the ability to be able to continue going, continue going. But the correlation with that and performance, what happens is the performance starts to dip off after a while. So what the guys have got from us, from working with us for the months they work with us, is a form of resilience. So we provide them with a whole range of aspects. We class them as tools to deal with the situations, which then enables them to maintain their performance over the duration. Because obviously different criteria, different elements are going to happen to different teams. So if we can formulate a package that's completely bespoke for them, which we did with these guys. So for example, a personality assessment, so they understand each other a little bit better, which may help them communicate a bit better, as an example. But we do other things in other areas just to help them cope with the stress. So that's kind of how we look at it. We've got mental toughness and then their mental resilience and how we build that.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Do you help them with being able to make sensible decisions? Because if it's just them in the middle of the sea, they've got to navigate. You know, they've got to do some stuff which actually is quite technically demanding. They can't just sit there and row. They've got to do other stuff as well. You've got to maintain the ability to think very carefully and well under extreme conditions. Did you help them with that?
Absolutely. And decision-making, like you said, is a huge part of it. The lads being rugby players and having a sports background is really helpful for that. And they're used to then being tired and trying to still make good decisions and still have good still kind of skill acquisition. However, rugby match is a little bit shorter than rowing across the ocean. So there's a cumulative fatigue effect where after days and days, their body's getting more tired. Their body's overall mental fatigue and cognitive fatigue builds up. So that's all part of the pathway that we support the teams and the guys with, is understanding that what comes with sleep deprivation, what comes with the physical side of it, and then the importance to make good decisions under fatigue. And we help them with that in terms of giving clear processes and a few models to work through, so that even when tired and fatigued, they don't forget certain things, and then they can use those models to make good decisions or the best decisions they can under that fatigue.
All right, let's bring in the rowers. Were there any times when you were just absolutely exhausted and you found yourself kind of struggling to make good decisions and to navigate? And tell me, was the navigation, the act of navigation, was that hard work, or was it all just GPS? I mean, presumably you had to think about it.
For us, you say about steering and navigation, 6 hours into our journey, at our first waypoint, which is 20 nautical miles out of 3,000, our auto helm broke, which is what directs the boat, and it will automatically change your rudder to a course. So we spent 2 or 3 days trying to fix that, and then we made the decision to manually steer the whole way across the Atlantic, which means that someone's always... You have two ropes which you can hand steer with, which change the rudder. For 39 days, me and Ollie always had to be not just rowing, but switched into directing the boat as well. Whereas the 43 other teams just put their auto helm on, press the button to change their course, and then all they have to focus on is rowing. So mentally, for us, it was more draining having to stay switched on, always focusing on your course instead of just sitting on the seat and rowing.
So how did you do that? Were you always looking at a compass then when you were rowing?
So you have an analog compass on the boat, but you also have a little repeater screen which shows you your course. So for our row, it was anywhere from 240 to 260. So as long as it was always in that range, we always knew we were going in the right direction. But obviously, like I said, if you took 10 minutes off, you could be pointing back the way you came, or you could be going 300 degrees north. So yeah, the tools that Tom and Luke gave us to try and stay resilient and mentally aware of what we were doing really helped in those situations, because we always had to be switched on. There was no time where we could just relax and row as such.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. Did they give you advice? I'm assuming they did, but tell us about it, on food and drink, because presumably there's not a lot of space for storage, and you've got to think very carefully about food that keeps the energy up, etc.
Obviously, rowing across the Atlantic is a physically demanding challenge, but working with Tom and Luke especially was important, because I think both George and I can agree that actually it was probably mentally tougher than it was physically. So regarding the food and drink side of things, the drink, you don't have much choice. It's water. That's it. We had a desalinator that would turn the seawater into drinking water. And then food was very much just George and I's decision. We had to make sure we took what we wanted to eat. But yeah, working with Luke and Tom was primarily focused on making sure that we had the sort of mental resilience to keep going. Not only that, but also the team dynamics. I think from what we've learned from this experience, a lot of teams have some questionable team dynamics going into the row, and certainly then when they finish. But George and I were best friends for 11 years now. So for us, we had no issues, and we're very pleased about that. But that was, yeah, working together as a team and having the mental resilience was the most important thing with working with Luke and Tom, for sure.
Oh, that was a question I was going to ask at the end, actually, but you touched on it then. So it's fine. You are still friends. You started off as friends. You sat in a little boat that's 8 meters long for 30 days, and you're still friends.
Yes. I think we had tired spats, tired words, but then 5 minutes later, you say sorry and you just get on with it.
Yeah.
Also, as much as it's a race and you want to do well, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. You don't want to sit on a boat with someone and hate them from day one. There's no point. It will ruin your experience and make it an unenjoyable trip. So me and Ollie did make an effort to be as nice as possible, understand the other person's going through the same thing. If you're having a bad day, like why they're having a bad day, or if they're in a bad mood, it's probably something that you're feeling as well. So we tried to talk. If you realize someone was in a bad mood, talk to them about it, find the problem, which we did for 99% of the time. And that 1% of the time, we probably had an argument for about 5 minutes, and that was about it.
Yeah.
All right.
And that probably happened maybe once, maybe twice, considering 30 days. Yeah, we were very pleased about that. And again, that was massive credit to working with Luke and Tom, because I don't think I think it would have been harder for us if we had not, because the amount of times we would have said, like, right, I'm going to be open, which is not something George and I would normally say. But again, working with Luke and Tom was talking about our openness and making sure that if there was ever a problem, you'd talk about it there and then.
Yeah, good. All right. That's interesting. Good. Thank you. I've got a question for you, which is, should any of us find ourselves in a similar situation, cast out at sea in a small vessel? This myth, drinking your own urine, all right? Is that something that I know you had something to desalinate the water, but if it had broken down or something, is this a myth? Is that something that helps people cast adrift at sea?
Honestly, I no idea how to even answer that, because that didn't come to.
I think
any
if
point
you,
did we think?
I think if you saw the colour in our dehydrated state, you probably wouldn't want to do that. I would say
something that if we are stuck in that situation, we're going to have to make a decision at the time. All right. Another practical one. What about large tankers, large boats? They're not going to see you 8 meters long. They just run right over you. Did you have any close calls, or did you take a route where you didn't really come across any big ships?
Fortunately, every boat that is certainly making a transatlantic crossing, no matter the size, is fitted with something called AIS, which is essentially a radar. So although, yes, physically, we would not have been seen by one of these big tankers, whoever's driving that tanker at the time in the bridge would have seen that there is a vessel there, and we had our AIS on, so we would have been seen. There were certainly some times where we had to radio some boats, though, and just say, look, heads up, have you seen us? Please don't run us over. But yeah, they always get back to you on the radio and say, yeah, no worries, we've seen you, we'll avoid you. But again, because we're moving so slowly, it's pretty easy for those big boats to avoid us.
And how close were they when you thought, right, I better get on the radio?
So I was in the stern cabin where the radio and the AIS was. So if anyone come within 5 nautical miles, I'd probably start to radio them. And they were pretty accommodating. They realized what you're doing. They know you can't change direction, so they would steer clear, wish you good luck, and you'd see them go off into the distance. I think our closest one was probably a mile away, but we'd already radioed ahead. We'd radioed ahead. We know they're not going to hit us, and they just come straight past you. But when you see them and realize how small you are, these cargo ships are 200, 300 meters long, and it's pretty intimidating, and you realize how small and insignificant you are.
Fantastic. All right. Yeah, I'm just thinking, sitting here slightly terrified at the story. All right. So look, you've taken us through some dramatic parts of your story, your journey, your training, etc. You've said you're still friends, which is a fantastic achievement, fantastic thing to say. Would you consider doing something like this again? And would you recommend it to anyone else who's thinking it might be fun to give it a go?
I think we're both probably of the same mindset on this one. We definitely would do it again and would do a similar challenge, but I don't think we will do it again just because of the very extensive hard work we had to do before the row. You know, we signed up over 3 years ago, 3 years of hard training and hard work. We had to work with lots of sponsors and try and help fundraise the campaign. And it took a lot of our time. But we absolutely loved it when we were out there. And when we got to Antigua and when we made land, I think it is an experience. And again, I'll let George speak for himself, but it's an experience that we will always treasure. Couldn't recommend it enough to anyone else. I just think now that we've been and done it, it's going to be, yeah, it'd be hard to top that. So, but yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
When you got off, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm a very similar mindset. Like, I would do it again. It hasn't scared me off, but it is such a commitment. And also, you would never get that first time feeling back, which was incredible. And if you could bottle that up and keep it, it's amazing. And I would 100% recommend it to everyone. It's just, it's very difficult and not that accessible. It's a lot of hard work, but it will be the best thing it's the best thing I've ever done, and maybe the best thing I will ever do, I would imagine.
You got plenty of time left. Don't wish your life away. Final question. How much money did you make and where did it go?
So I think as of this morning, we're on 18,940, according to the GoFundMe, which is obviously a great figure. And the charity that we've been working with, and this is all going towards, is it started out something called the Wave Wrangler Charity, which works directly in partnership with the British Heart Foundation. And the funds that are being raised are specifically going towards funding defibrillators in underprivileged sports centres. And the reason why this is all come about is because I used to play rugby with someone called Elliot Arwin. Elliot Arwin was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation at the age of 27 and had a pacemaker fitted, but he certainly didn't let it get in the way of him, had the pacemaker fitted and actually completed this same Atlantic crossing in 2023 going into 2024, and became the first person in history to complete this Atlantic crossing with a pacemaker fitted. And so he bought the boat, did the crossing, and set up this Wave Wrangler charity, which, as I said, directly provides funds for the British Heart Foundation. And then we wanted to carry that on and carry on that legacy, and have done exactly that. And I think there's even a team doing it this year too, looking to carry it on. So yeah, it's kind of something that Elliot wants to happen, not every year, but you know, keep this going. And we were very proud to kind of raise funds for the same cause.
Okay, if people are listening and think...
Please add if I've missed anything, but I was going to say, I think that's pretty much it.
No, you hit the nail on the head.
Good. All right, if people are listening and think, right, that is a good cause, I'm impressed by what these guys have done, I would like to donate some money, how can they do it?
So our GoFundMe link is on our Instagram, which will be The Wave Wranglers. And if they are not on social media, they can go directly on GoFundMe and it'll be The Wave Wranglers. If you search it, it'll be on there. If not, on Google, there is a website called Wave Wrangler and you'll find a donation page on that as well.
Excellent. All right, look, thank you so much, all four of you, for taking the time to chat. It's much appreciated and it really is quite a fascinating and extraordinary tale you've been able to tell. So many thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mike. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were George Atfield and Oliver Rathbone. They did the rowing, and the team that helped them prepare were Luke Horrocks and Tom Hanlon. And please do remember that if you are suffering from back pain because you sit down a lot, probably not as much sitting down as those guys did rowing across the Atlantic, but if you sit at your desk and you're worried about your posture and you have back pain, whatever, do check out my website, relaxbackuk.com. There you can see the details of the back app chair, which is almost certainly going to help you. It's helped hundreds of people who are dealing with poor posture and back pain. And you can, if you're in the UK, you can arrange to try it out for a few days to see if it works for you. So thank you very much for listening to today's show. And please do have a good week. Until next week.
The station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.